floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and yes, 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 you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. LA is gray and chilly, and there's a big storm coming, but not to worry, I am leaving town to go to Las Vegas for a Foo Fighter gig out there at a big festival, and I'm sure that's going to be a hoot. I'm going to miss all the rain. Sadly, I'm going to miss all the waves that the rain are bringing. But you know, whatever, it'll be a good time. A little Vegas weekend. You know, I gotta be honest, Vegas, probably my least favorite place on the entire planet. I don't like gambling. I don't like clubbing. I don't like eating, all you can eat buffets. I don't like any of it. But I'm sure it's gonna be fun. Show's gonna be good, no doubt. Fingers crossed. What could go wrong? Hey, I want to tell you that there is a show coming up. I think I kind of alluded to it in the last podcast that I put up, but I am opening for my brother's band, Face to Face, on December 27th down at the Locker Room at the Garden Amphitheater in Garden Grove. That's down in Orange County. Listen, I'm sure by the 27th of December, you are going to be sick as fuck of your family, and you're going to be ready to get out of the house. And you're going to be ready to come listen to some sensitive acoustic music, because I'm just going to play this one by myself. No band, just me and an acoustic guitar singing some tunes. And I'm smack dab in the middle of that. Face to Face actually doing a 3-night acoustic show stretch. So they're playing the 26th, 27th, 20th. And I'll be there for the 27th. So get your tickets now. You can go to my website, chrisshiflettmusic.com. You can get tickets or just Google that shit or just show up on the night. Whatever, just come on down to the show. Also, just in time for the holidays, if you didn't grab a t-shirt or a hat at any of my gigs this year, we've got all that shit's collecting dust, and we're trying to blow it out, having a big merch sale. Orders over $30 get a free gift of some sort. I don't know what that is. It's probably great. There's like I said, t-shirts, hats. There's the beautiful design that is not ripping off the Sex Wax logo. I want to make that very clear. It is not ripping off the Sex Wax logo, but similar. Then there's the Chris Shiflett for President t-shirt, West Coast Town t-shirt. We got it all, baby. It's all there, right up there on the website. So go to my website, get yourself some merch, little stocking stuffers for your friends and family. All right, let's pay some bills. All right, you know them, you love them, Zounds.com. That's ZZOUNDS.com. Nobody makes the best gear from the best brands more affordable on the internets than Zounds. You never have to pay full price all at once. When you buy from Zounds, if you use their exclusive payment plans, and Zounds, of course, never charges interest, ever. Not ever, ever. Everyone else will. Read their fine print. That's not going to happen to you at Zounds, baby. So get on over there today and get what you need. Zounds.com. All right, let's get on over to the interview. Okay, so I wasn't really familiar with Northern Ireland's Foy Vance's music prior to interviewing him, but he's one of these guys that when I started digging around doing a little research, I realized, Jesus Christ, this guy's got like a million records. How have I been missing this? Two of those records he released back-to-back this year, one recorded in Muscle Shoals and one recorded in Memphis, respectively. As a matter of fact, my buddy, Matt Ross Spang, who engineered West Coast Town for me, worked on his latest Memphis record, and it's really good. You should listen to it. Check it out. Unfortunately, I ran out of time on the day that I was interviewing him, so hopefully Foy Vance will come back soon to walk in the floor, because he was really fun to talk to and just a charming, smart guy that makes great music. So this is Foy Vance on Walking the Floor. Okay, so when I saw with your latest record, see, there you go. When I saw with your latest record that you'd recorded it in Memphis and at Philips Recording Service, the first thing that popped into my head was my man Matt Ross Spang. So then I looked and there he was. Yeah. I was like, of course he's, you know, of course he's the guy that did this record, you know, because he's the mayor of Memphis. But So I texted him yesterday when I was sort of putting some questions together to get some, you know, the inside scoop, like give me an inside look at this guy.
This could be interesting.
I'll tell you what he came back with. He came back with he loves chicken tenders.
I do love a chicken tender. I'd be partial to a chicken tender with a buffalo sauce. Or Hattie B's. You ever had that in Nashville?
Oh, yeah.
And Prince's, that's another good one. But the Prince's heat, it's too, like, it's like dusty. It's just like, the, it's almost like they just pour more, like, spicy dust on it or something.
I gotta say, I'm not an aficionado of the... of the hot chicken, I just did a tour with a guy who's like, who runs a, he's got an Instagram account of doing just wing reviews.
Wow.
So I started to get kind of schooled in the finer points of these things, but it's, I don't know it really. But
do you know what? I don't eat it that hot anymore, to be honest. It used to be like a challenge, you know. Right. I once had wings in Wimberley, which is about 50 minutes outside Austin.
That sounds like a song title.
Yeah, right.
Wings and Wimberley.
I had to sign a disclaimer to eat this shit.
No.
I swear, yeah. I
had why? Because they're so top secret?
It's so hot.
Oh, it's just so hot. Right,
it's so hot.
Because like, you might hurt yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet it was the next morning that you were thinking about that disclaimer.
Good Lord Almighty. It was, yeah. I think that was the last time I ever had anything that hot, to be honest. Well, I learned a lesson.
You just mentioned Nashville. Why did you go to Memphis to make this record and not Nashville? You know, I know it's sort of... being it's talked about, like, you know, the record earlier this year was like the soul record and this one's the Americana record kind of thing, but why'd you pick Nashville, or why'd you pick Memphis, and specifically why'd you pick Phillips?
Well, Matt Rossbein.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
So I reached out to him and we just chatted, you know, about instrumentation, and I'd sort of demoed all the songs for this in my studio, you know, mapped it out type thing.
Yeah.
Sent it to him. Had a phone call and said, you know, talked about instrumentation, and then talked about the room to do it in, and he said, Sam Phillips Recording Studio, trust me.
You know, I'd never even, so I worked, the way that I met Matt is I worked on a record with him a few years ago, and you know, of course, I love tons of music that's come out of Memphis, but I don't really know anything about it, and he's just like a wealth of knowledge, and I didn't even know there was a Phillips Recording Service studio. They don't do a whole lot of hoo-ha outreach. It's not like Sun Records. Like, everybody knows Sun Records, you know, and you know Stax, and you know some of those things. Mm-hmm. But I had never even heard that there was this other studio Sam Phillips built after, you know, he sold his company and everything and started this whole new thing. And it's for people that don't know, because I went there when last time I was in Memphis.
Isn't it incredible?
I mean, it's like, and they've kept it exactly the same.
It's like going back in time.
Yeah.
In his office.
Yeah.
The one you're not really allowed to talk about, but it's just like walking into it's wild, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. And you know what, man? That room, I love that those studios got it right. Because a lot of studios, when it all started to go digital or whatever, got rid of their echo chambers.
Sure. Got rid of everything.
You know what I mean? It was like, that's more space. Let's put another studio, a writing studio in there or something or whatever. But it's still there. And it's just incredible to, you know, just to write it up and down on shit and hear it just go further into the 50s. You know, it's like 59, 58. You know, it's just like you're going back in time as you ride this theater. You know, it's incredible. Incredible space. Yeah, so Matt picked the musicians as well.
Okay. You know. Did you call on some of the like you know, aging legends of the Memphis music scene?
I 100% left that to Matt. You know what I mean? Okay. Because I wanted someone on the ground. You know what I mean? I just trusted Matt when I spoke to him.
Sure.
I knew that he had a real handle on who's who and who's going to work well together. You know, because he's worked with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I sort of just trusted his judgment to put together the right group of people for this, and we talked about instrumentation, what I wanted and whatnot, and he was like, okay, and he put it together. So it was like,
did you cut it live?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
the vocals and everything
live. So the plan was to do, I actually was only meant to record 5 songs. It was meant to be an EP.
okay,
so we had 2 days of recording, 1 day of mixing, job done,
right?
But on day one we recorded 6 songs, and I said, well, I've got I've got four or five more here. Should we do that tomorrow? And then the next day, then we recorded those. And then on the third day, when we rose again, we mixed it and then listened through at the end of the night. And I was like, that's an album I'm not going to take.
And does he kind of do that thing where he's kind of mixing it as he goes?
Dude, he's incredible that way. When you would walk out of that room and, you know, into the booth, and he'd say, okay, are you ready to listen back? Because what we'd always go in, we'd play it through once, then we'd come in and listen.
Right.
And then go back in, record it three times, move on type thing. But every time we come in for that first listen, we'd be listening going, fucking hell, man. It sounds like a record already.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's just got it. He likes to, excuse me, he likes to dial it in.
Yeah, yeah. And he knows every nook and cranny of that room. Like, yes, the back sir. Of his hand. Yeah. It's really interesting because to hear you say, I wasn't aware that you had recorded it so fast.
Yeah.
Because when I think of, like, you know, we made a record in 2 days, to me that's like something I did when I was like 16 out of necessity.
Yeah.
Out of budgetary constraints, yeah. You know what I mean? And it sounded like garbage. You know what I mean? Your record does not sound like it was in a rush. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like, we only had these 2 days and we had to jam. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds like you took your time.
Do you know what, man? The energy was magical. For me, it really was. You know, it was just such a different way to make a record. I'm usually so involved. I'm usually, you know, involved in, you know, I know everyone that's there. It was lovely.
Micromanage everybody's parts. Right.
That sort of thing. And it was just great to walk in, like the old days, the songwriter, the singer-songwriter comes in, the band are there, and okay, here are the songs, play through them, and move on, record the next one. And that's what I wanted it to be recorded in that way. It's important because that's the way all the music that I love from that era was recorded like that.
Right.
And I understand that that's about getting the right people who know how to converse musically, you know. When, and those guys were incredible. I always refer
who
to them
were
as
those guys?
Matt Rossbang and the Tennessee 10. It's official.
Right.
It's official. I'm going to get a t-shirt made. it was a collection of 10 musicians that he got.
Mm. And they're just learning your songs on the fly right then and there and off to the races?
I think he had sent them the five that we were meant to record.
Oh, okay.
They had heard them
beforehand,
the demos, but the other ones that we recorded the next day, they had never heard, no. But listen, they're steeped in that tradition, you know, they're steeped in that type of music, and they play, that's what they do day in, day out,
right?
You know, and you could really tell, you could really tell, you know, they didn't have to put anything on, they were just responding to each other, you know. And I don't know, they all had their own little magic, you know, the talk between the mandolin and the guitar player and the Hammond player, Al Gamble. Do you know him?
Mm-mm.
Good Lord almighty, that guy's a monster. Okay, it's just a wash of sound, you know.
Right.
He's a, and I could hear him doing stuff, and then you could hear it echoed elsewhere around the room. You know, it was just inspiring.
Yeah,
it was a really inspiring way to record. You know,
Memphis is an interesting town. I mean, did you spend a lot of time there?
Not really.
Just those few days.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, it's such an important place for American music.
Mm.
You know, it's like such a historical place. It's like the birth of rock and roll. You could argue, you know, kind of happened there, as well as like so many other things. But but it like, what's it? I don't want to offend the Memphis listeners. Certainly don't want to offend Matt. But it's like, it's got that like kind of shitty Disneyland blues street.
Yeah.
And then the downtown's just kind of shitty. And, you know, they're at least, you know, I mean,
Blue Street.
You know what I mean? Like, it hasn't like, it doesn't seem to embrace. There's other towns like that too, like Bakersfield. I'm obsessed with like the Bakersfield sound and Buck Owens and Merle Haggard and all that shit. It's another place that doesn't really embrace its history the way it should.
Yeah.
But Memphis is one of those places. Like, it's not,
it's kind of,
it hasn't
weird
had that like Nashville makeover. Not that everything about the Nashville makeover is positive, but, you know, like Nashville's kind of a boomtown. It feels like Memphis is like, doesn't get, it's not like, there should be more of a, I don't know, hustling and bustling, like some sort of like, the downtown should just be like the Rockabilly Museum Street or something, you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I did spend a little bit of time there and was aware of it, you know, sort of feeling a bit run down and under appreciating itself a little bit, you know, because it is it's got a real magic to it, Memphis, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many places like that, though. I remember the first time going to Detroit. This is like, just, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, whatever. And just being, you know, seeing so vividly the kind of the residue of a once booming industry.
Yes.
All these huge, gorgeous, beautifully architectured buildings, land dormant with
disrepair.
You know what I mean? It was just like,
no,
you were completely surrounded by it.
When I first started touring, I had the exact, it's the same story all through the Rust Belt. You know, it's the same thing when you go to, this was when I first started touring in like the mid 90s, it was before the sort of hipsterization of the world where all the downtowns had been reclaimed and turned into fancy boutiques and expensive coffee places and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So you'd go to these towns like Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Detroit and wherever, and it was exactly what you're talking about. It was just the downtown was this like an empty, rotting husk of this once great industrial, this is the deindustrialization of the world. You know, that's sort of the effect of that.
Yeah.
Sad.
It is sad, isn't it? It is sad.
I mean, I think maybe now that's improved somewhat in some ways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I always look at that and I go, opening like a $7 a cup coffee shop in an old factory, it doesn't really replace all those thousands of jobs. Like, it's not, it's nice now, we can enjoy those brick buildings, but it's not really the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But all these places, you always find that, people are very industrious, Detroit versus everyone is one of their mottos down there, you often find that. I always felt like that about back home, actually, in Northern Ireland, because there's no real music industry infrastructure to speak of. None of us, to get heard in any way, it was like a hothouse effect,
right?
To get heard, you had to really stretch up and get out and get off to the mainland type thing. And what it did was it just created loads of great singers who were hungry beyond their means,
Right.
It produced some great songwriters.
And wouldn't towns like Belfast and Glasgow and Manchester and Liverpool have gone through sort of a similar experience to what the Detroits and the Clevelands and the Pittsburghs went through? Those were like the industrial hubs of the UK.
Yeah. You see that the world over, don't you? You really do. Even the town I'm from, Bangor, County Down, which is a beautiful town in so many respects, lovely people, right by the sea, but it's had a big kind of, missing tooth in its smile of the seafront, for so long. It's just like, and sort of shitty shops opening up, everywhere's got a bit shitter. Either that or we're just getting older.
Right.
It's hard to say, right?
You know what I mean? Yeah, I think about that all the time, just the way I process music or just popular culture. It's like, I don't know how much of it is, I don't think my opinion's right about anything because, it's all up to the individual or whatever. But it's like, in some ways you just get a little more closed off the older you get.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Suffer fools less gladly, right?
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't bullshit. Like that in my day.
Yeah, right. I remember when this was nothing but fields.
Yeah. okay. Well, back to your record or your latest two. Did you record them both before either of them came out? Like, did you have them both in the can, the Muscle Shoals one and the Memphis one, and then decide to put them out this way? Did you always have that concept?
So the original idea was to be in and out in like 10 days or whatever it is. So fly in the Muscle Shoals or into Alabama, 2 days recording, 1 day mixing, get 5 songs, have a day off to drive to Memphis, 2 days recording, 1 day mixing.
Oh, so you did it all back to back?
Yeah, back to back. But in Muscle Shoals, I got 6 songs. So I was on course. I was like, okay, there's 6. I'll pick 5 out of that.
Yeah.
That'll be that EP. And then when we got to Memphis, as I say, it was just so magical. We just floated through the songs. They kind of sang and played themselves almost. And we got the whole album in the 2 days. So then Ed, my label boss, he said, well, why don't you just go back to Muscle Shoals and record another 4 and release 2 albums? So I did.
That was going to be my next question, was how did you get your label to go along with this? But that kind of explains that, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that like working in Muscle Shoals? There's 2...
Yeah, so there's Muscle Shoals Sound.
Right.
That's the Swamper studio. That was their own studio.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Where, Wild Horses was recording, the Stones recording, and all that. But Fame Studios, that's where, Wilson Pickett, Percy Sledge,
Is that where you did yours?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Where I Never Loved a Man, by Aretha Franklin was recorded. In fact, I had this real surreal moment when I was recording a song called Pain Never Hurt Me Like Love, and I was looking out the window at Spooner Oldham, the same Spooner Oldham, sitting at the same Wurlitzer in the same room where he came up with the riff for doom, I just had this moment where I was singing, and I don't know, it felt like being on holiday making those records. It really did. It just felt like I was just watching the coolest shit happen.
So for the Muscle Shoals one, so you did have some of the legends.
Yeah, I had Spooner Oldham, and David Hood, the bass player. Had him. Yeah, that was badass being around them.
I mean, do you ever get like, I find it sometimes hard when you're trying to work with somebody who you look up to like that, to really be sort of honest about whether or not you like a part they're doing, or you know what I mean? Did you have any issues with that?
No, I didn't actually. It always those guys were great, but the whole it was like 10 musicians there as well, was it? We had four horns, and everyone kind of knew their parts, you know. It was blueprinted pretty well. I'd recorded all the songs. It was, here's the shape, here's the form, here's the key, here's where I'm gonna stop, you know. So everyone kind of came in quite, you know, tooled up,
right?
You know, and there was just the odd oh, maybe play Hammond instead of Wurlitzer and that, you know, take the reverb off the guitar slit, or you know, there was the odd thing there, but mostly everyone knew exactly what they had to do because they play that kind of stuff all the time, you know.
And those studios are still active, they're still working all the time. Yeah, that's fascinating.
In fact, Fame has just opened up the Studio B again, like it's a whole new desk in there, and got another writing studio upstairs. Yeah, it's happening.
Wow,
it's happening, which is good.
That's interesting, because there must have been like a lot of years that it wasn't very busy down there, you would think. I don't know the history of it exactly.
There was always folks going there to record, you know, but not to the scale they are now. I think that documentary, you know, the Rick Hall documentary on that sort of, you know, I think that reignited everyone's sort of interest. It was like, oh shit, that's still there, and you can go down and record there.
Right.
You know,
like American country music, and by extension Americana, are so heavily influenced by British and Irish folk music that was brought over here, you know, hundreds of years ago, and evolved into, you know, country music. And some of the songs on your latest record are like, draw from that, it sounds like, pretty heavily. Like, were you more influenced by like the homegrown folk music, the British folk music, Irish folk music, or sort of the American interpretation of it?
Yes.
All of the above.
You know what I mean? Yeah. To me, it all sounded like music. You know, it's interesting to hear you start the question like that, because someone did say to me, you know, like, how did you get into Americana music? You know, what inspired that? Like, how did that come about? Or, you know, you're from Ireland, and I'm thinking, like, to me, that's part of where that music comes from. You know, we were part of the conversation, as was Scotland, as were, you know, was Africa, as was, you know what I mean? This was the greatest melting pot of all time, you know, cultural melting pot, musical melting pot. So, that music doesn't feel a million miles from Irish music. You know, I think any music that's native to a land, if you go back far enough, it's the same shit. It's a story about, you know, I loved him and he went to sea and I came back, or I loved her but she loved another, or you know, we went to war, you know.
Universal truths.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, it's stories, kind of.
So everybody gets their heart broken, you know.
Yeah. And I feel that same plumb line, if you like, from Irish music through anything that's happened here in country, or, you know, it all feels pretty similar to me. But
Like, what do you make of, I mean, I assume you've spent a considerable amount of time over here touring and doing your thing, but what do you make of, like, the sort of the American obsession with all things Irish? I mean, you must have noticed that in your travels.
Yes, I have.
Right.
I have. It can be both a blessing and a curse, I've realized. You know what I mean? I get that, you know. I get that, because it's romantic, isn't it?
Right.
It's romantic.
Yeah. And there's, you know, obviously that there was such a massive Irish, you know, migration here.
Yeah, completely, man. Yeah. Completely. It's in your blood.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I feel like there's like American Irish, or Irish American, is sort of a distinctly separate thing that oftentimes people hear confused for actually being Irish.
All right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Right. I mean, I don't know. Who cares at the end of the day? But, you know, it's just a funny thing. I always wonder, like, for people from, especially, you know, you're from the North, like, yeah. Growing up, when I grew up, you only ever heard one thing about the North.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That was it. Yeah. You know, it was like, and
don't go there, mate. You're going to get shot.
Right. Or whatever. You know, like, when I was a kid, everybody going to, you know, Free Bobby Sands.
Yeah.
Protests and all that sort of thing, you know what I mean? So you sort of, that's the only thing. And I've only ever been to Belfast a couple times in recent years, you know, and it's, and I think it's undergone a huge, just, you know, it's a nice
major
town, you know?
Change.
Yeah, but
major
what was it change. Like for you growing up there in you know, whenever it was, the 80s?
Yeah, do you know what? It was, in one sense, it was like, it wasn't that bad, you know, it never really affected us too much. But then another sense, like, you know, shit did happen. Like, I was around the corner from, there was a bomb that went off in Bangor, a car bomb, and I was about, as a crow flies, about 500-600 yards from it, but thankfully it was around the corner, so the windows came in on us when we were lying sleeping, because the windows just went in everywhere, you know,
right.
Within the radius of the explosion, so that happened. Do you know what I mean?
But
at the same time, it was kind of a lot of fun, you know. We were up thinking, this is why, you know, because we were just young and just thought, this is, what is this, you know,
right.
I didn't understand the political situation, you know, and I was just a kid going, holy shit, look at the streets.
Yeah,
I'm running through it going, this is wild. I forgot about that until you asked me, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what we like to do. We like to uncover old wounds on this podcast. It's a form of therapy.
Yeah, but that's the only time I was ever close to anything
right.
like that. You know, there's a bit of trouble, but no more trouble than you see anywhere else,
right.
really. You know, I think the media, as ever, paint whatever picture they want to paint of a place, and then, you know, but when you actually go there, feet on the ground, it's never quite like that, you know.
Right.
It was a cool place to grow up. I liked it. No bullshit.
Right.
That sort of a place. But I also liked getting out.
Like, growing up there, like, do you... You know, it seems like, from somebody who grew up far away from that part of the world, like, the advantage would be you could go kind of easily go over to France or go over to the rest of, you know, mm-hmm. shoot down to Dublin or mm-hmm. go over onto the continent, whatever, you know, or go over to England. Did you spend much time sort of traveling around and soaking up the other cultures and the other music scenes kind of around Europe?
Always, man. My dad was nomadic, and it's just transferred to me. So we all, you know, by the time I was leaving my house, I'd lived in 21 houses. Or I can't remember. We moved about a lot.
Right.
And we lived in the States for a while. We lived in Canton, Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah. Were you born here or something?
No, I was born in Bangor, County Down. But I was 8 months old, I think, and we moved to Oklahoma.
Ah.
And
do you have any memories of that?
I do, yeah. I mean, more sort of sensory. Sometimes I'll smell something or hear a song. If I hear "You Light Up My Life," I can see the living room, and I see the record player, and I see my Bert and Ernie. I had a Bert and Ernie record player. You know, so like little snippets. But to be honest, I think it's probably made up of pictures that we've had over the years,
right.
and also when we lived there, we would send tapes, audio tapes back to our family. So we grew up listening to them, you know,
right.
to hear us as kids, and also I've probably pieced together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That's funny. So when you went back to Ireland, did you have like an American accent?
I did, yeah. Full on American accent.
Funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to go to Ireland. There's me saying that on a tape. I don't want to go to Ireland.
Oh no. That must have made you like ripe to be picked on at school for until it snapped back.
Yeah, I think it didn't last too long, you know. It didn't last long. I don't know when it went, actually. Because I was young. I was like 5 when we come back. So, you know, still very susceptible to whatever's going on around you.
Sure, sure.
My accent probably changed within a week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, it's funny, you know, before I was born, I have 2 older brothers, and my family, my dad was a teacher, and they lived in Malaysia.
Wow.
For a minute, you know, a year or so, right before I was born. And so the only English speaking school to go to was a like a British school. So my oldest brother had a little British accent. My dad was apparently like so thrilled, like, oh, this is great. But then they moved back to America and he lost it right away, you know.
Can he still put it on though?
Oh, he puts it on great. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that, yeah, who knows? I never thought about that until just now, but he's great at imitating accents, so maybe it comes from that, who knows. But it is funny, at that age you're just a sponge,
aren't you?
Yeah.
What is that, there's an old Jewish saying, give me the boy to the age of 7 and I'll give you the man. You know what I mean? Like, in that, those years are
right,
so formative.
Yeah
You know, no pressure when you have kids, eh? Just don't fuck it up for 7 years.
Do you have kids?
I do, yeah.
I got 3 boys myself.
Yeah. 3 boys, wow. That's as soon as there's more of them than there is of you guys, I think it starts to get worrying.
You're outnumbered. Well, it's funny because my oldest is 16 now, and he's like, you know, I think the days are behind us where I could be any, not that I would be a physical threat to him, but like, I look at him and I'm like, he beat me arm wrestling recently. I was like, fuck, it's fucking over. How am I ever going to tell this fucking kid what to do again?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Would you mind bringing your laundry down?
Yeah. Would that be cool?
If it's cool with you.
Could you be home by 10?
I mean, no problem if it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that ahead of me. Yeah, my daughter's 16.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And my son is going to be 3 on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, wow. You believe? So you've got, you're sort of in both ends of that.
Yes, sir. Thing. Yeah,
still some sleepless nights.
That was
nights on both sides of that equation.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It was heavy going. Like, having a kid in your 40s is no joke. It's no joke, man. That fucked me up so bad for about a year. Just sleep deprivation, man. It leads to psychosis.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? They use it as a torture.
Yeah. Well, that's why everybody gets divorced when their kids are like, you know, 7 years old or whatever, because they've been like out of their minds for just long enough that they can no longer fucking function.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's heavy going. But a lot of fun too, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it.
It just keeps getting better and better. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I just say that every year. I'm like, it's just more and more fun watching your kids grow up and watching the good little people that they turn into.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Assuming they do. When did you start playing music yourself?
Don't remember.
Really?
Just straight away. Always singing, always sang.
Really?
They're, like, some of the tapes that we sent back from Oklahoma to my granny, it's got me singing on it. I must have been 3. And I sang You Light Up My Life, the whole song.
Really?
And when the boys are trying to join in, I'm shouting at them, no, I'm singing it.
Right.
I'm singing it.
Yeah.
And if I have to sing the whole song on my own. So music was always there, but I never was surrounded by other people that were into that, and when I was, it was so, I never saw it as a way out. I never thought that I could do it,
right,
until I was already doing it for a couple of years in a band playing covers in pubs for a couple of years, when I realized, oh, hang on, this is the only thing I do.
Right. At what age was that?
That would have been probably 19, 20.
Oh, okay. And did you play like all through high school and through those years in bands?
It was a secret. As soon as I left high school, I joined a band when I would have been 16. But it was always a private pleasure, you know, but right. We would always sing around the house. There was always, growing up, if we had a family gathering, my dad would have the guitar out and he'd be singing, and my granny would sing, and I'd have to sing the Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond, and you know what I mean? Yeah, we had all, so music was always there, and all my older brothers, 3 older brothers, all loved music and different types of music at that. So like, music was always front and center for me.
Yeah.
But I just didn't realize I could do it for a living until I was like in my early 20s.
And when did it become for a living? When did it become putting records out and touring and, you know,
sort of
turning pro, if you will?
Yeah. You know what? About when I was 22, I kind of thought, okay, I need to stop doing these covers. It's killing me. But I wasn't writing songs that were very good at the time. And I knew I just needed to go and take myself away. So I got married at 23. And me and my wife at the time moved to Lanzarote, the Canary Islands. And I did cover gigs there, but I was spending the days trying to write songs, you know. That was the first time I'd sort of set set my sights on, okay, let's get serious about this. Let's get a record together. Let's get an album out. And, but it just took me a long time to get my shit together. I didn't release an album until I was 32, but I was gigging all that time.
Right.
I was gigging all that time, and I was, you know, constantly sort of honing my craft, and I was in and out of work. You know, I would have to go back and take a job at this coffee importing. I used to import coffee into Northern Ireland. I'd have to take other jobs here and there, but that's when I started to, around 22, I realized that that's what I wanted to do, and I'd just make it work any which way I could.
And did you, at any point in all that, did you like move to London or move to Nashville, or you know what I mean, like move to the big city to make it kind of thing?
Yeah, I moved to London when I was about 29, and it was just not what I, you know, moving to London, if you're 17, 18 years old and you're moving in with a load of friends and you're starting a band, that's killer. And, you know, the energy there is going to be incredible. You're moving to London with, you know, a family. You know, my daughter was 3, 4 at the time. I can't remember when we moved there, 2 or 3. Dude, I just had to take whatever gig was going to right. pay for this dream that I couldn't afford.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I didn't have any chance to carve out a career path and go, okay, no, I'll release this album and then I'll do that and then we'll, you know. No, it's right. just work.
Yeah.
Work, the rent needs paid,
yeah.
kid needs shoes, that school's not cheap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just had to work all the time. It just took me a long time to get around to having a bit of headspace, you know, to get ahead of the game, which only really feels like it's happened in the last 3 or 4 years, to be quite frank. Yeah.
I mean, what was like your first, like your first kind of break in that sense? Like, cause I know you got some syncs on like Grey's Anatomy and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was it sort of around that you started to get maybe some wider exposure?
Well, do you know what, man, my take on it was, I knew, you know, by the time I'm releasing my first album, you know, I'm, you know, this baldy wee Irish guy that sings songs about heartache and cancer. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not going to get played on radio.
Right.
They're not going to be interested in me. And I wasn't really interested in radio anyway.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That's not where I went to listen to stuff that I like. You know what I mean? So my take was, well, if I have to work all the time, let me get as many support slots with as many artists as possible so as I can get, you know, from people of all different ages, all different... I think if you build, you know, my plan was if I build an audience like that live, just of years of just being the guy that always turns up every year, and then sooner or later I'll be able to go there and sell out a half decent sized room,
right?
You know, and make it work that way. So I just did. I took every gig that was going. You know what I mean? And I got, the more I'd said yes to stuff, you know, it's like the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like I started getting, you know, I got a support slot with Taj Mahal, and I got a support slot with Buddy Guy, and then went out with Bonnie Raitt.
Mm.
And I think just even, not to sound like a, you know, hit you with hippie bullshit, but like on a molecular level, doing shit like that, I don't know, it attracts the same thing, you know what I mean?
But those can also be tough gigs.
I wish I could articulate that. You know what I'm yeah, trying to say.
I know what you're trying. Yeah, absolutely.
Like what you put out is often what you can.
Sure, of course. Yeah, but those are tough gigs too sometimes, because you know when you're playing in front of, you know, Taj Mahal's fans,
mm-hmm.
they want to see Taj Mahal. You know, mm-hmm. there's that thing that makes those. You know, those are tough mm-hmm. gigs sometimes to cut your teeth on.
I love that challenge. I love the challenge.
If you can win that crowd over, exactly, like, you know you're doing something.
Yeah, I know. I love being on the back foot. I love it. You know, one of the best gigs, or most enjoyable gigs I ever had, I played a gig in Middlesbrough, like in the Midlands in England. And I got a slot in the sort of hip room, you know, which was, or, you know, my managers at the time were like, oh, they're so happy though. This is like the Radio 1 room or whatever. Yeah. Whatever. I can't remember. It was meant to be the cool bit.
Yeah.
And I did my slot in there. And everyone was sort of standing around, waiting to see, am I meant to like this or not? You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Because
it was the cool room.
Yeah.
And I had a bit of a sort of awkward, shitty gig. I won a few folks over, whatever. And then I got off and I was talking to the promoter who I got on with really well. And he was stressed out. And I said, what's up? And he says, oh man, there's a band are stuck in traffic. So we've, you know, I'm trying to get someone to fill like a 30 minute slot here. And I said, I'll do it. And he said, it's in the metal. It's on the metal stage. And I said, well, listen, I was just acoustic at the time.
Right.
You know,
right.
And like proper acoustics, like troubadour shit.
Yeah.
Know? And he was like, would you really? And I said, fuck yeah. If you need it filled, I'll go and do it. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Went in, started with an acoustic version of Back in Black, and then did Black Hole Sun. Yeah. And then just did my own set after that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was some of them were like sort of slow balladeer songs, and it was incredible. I think folks, certainly in that part of the world, that like metalheads, they're so used to nobody thinking they're cool that they don't give a fuck about what's cool. If it sounds good, they will like it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't give a you know.
But that's the funny thing with like almost any live crowd, and as performers, I think sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot with this. I know that I have for a long time, and I try to always remember this, but. You know, when you step up on stage in front of a room full of people, they want to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
They're not against you. They're like, don't fuck this up for us. You know what I mean? They're like, you have to, you know. So, but you can misread that energy in the room, and it's so easy when you're standing on stage. God, these fucking people hate us. And then to start kind of going down that sort of negative hole in your head, you know. But it's funny, like, it's... So often when I think a crowd is not into it, and that'll be the crowd that where you sell the most merch or get the most back slaps, or you know what I mean? It's a funny thing like that.
It's man. It's
insecure.
It can be a head fuck.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to do. I think about this often. It is a very peculiar thing to do, to be standing up there and have all those eyes looking at you. You know, okay.
Yeah.
What have you got for us?
Right.
You know,
you're so exposed.
Yeah.
You know?
And you get it. And if I stopped playing, shit would get real pretty quick, you know what I mean? Like, I've got to do something.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're gone, you know.
Yeah.
It's a peculiar thing.
Here are my deepest thoughts.
Yeah.
I hope you agree. Well, see, okay, so you know, this all, I was going to ask you this, but like, sort of where do you see yourself slotting in genre-wise? I mean, do you care? Does it matter? But, because like, you talked about like, you know, pop, mainstream pop music and pop radio and all that sort of thing, like, you know. You don't fit in that world, although your songs are real hooky and catchy, and you have some association with, you know, that you're on Ed Sheeran's label. Yeah, so I wonder where, like, the label and your team sort of try to slot you in, what lane, you know?
Well, that's at the minute driven just by design. I want to be at home a lot more.
Right.
I want to make a lot more music. Put a lot more albums out. The same next year, you know, like maybe 2-3 records next year.
Really?
Yeah, new stuff, but also old songs that I think I've got merit that unless I record them, no one's gonna hear them.
Right.
And I've got a studio, so you know.
And you can make a whole record in 3 fucking days.
Yeah, man.
So why not?
just get it done, you know. And to tour, not so much. I like the idea of maybe, you know.
Which is tough in this
12 day weeks
age.
A year.
Yeah. Because that's like, that's the whole thing nowadays, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know it is. I just, you know what? I don't know, man. I turn 45 next month.
Yeah.
And I'm just a bit too long in the tooth to be traveling around the country for 8 months of the year with 8 other farting blokes on a bus. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I do.
You hear me? It's like, it's time. The amount of times, I mean, I had a really existential night in the, was either Paris or maybe somewhere in Germany. And I remember we were just standing in the dressing room and, you know, it was a really shitty dressing room. You know, the shower, the water was stagnant and at the bottom of the shower, it was all yellow. You couldn't even wash. And I remember we were all just standing around looking at each other going like, what the fuck are we doing? When are we going to grow up and go home to our wives and kids? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What are we doing here? This is crazy. But then of course you get on stage and it all makes sense. But
yeah, all those feelings melt away.
Yeah, but so I love the live bit. I love the unity that happens in a room when you're playing live. I love that sense of we're here together in the same place, the same time, for the same reason. Let's have it.
Yeah,
I love it, but just not as much as I love my family and my house and the studio and songwriting.
Yeah,
I like songwriting. I like that. That's the most interesting bit of it for me, is the trying to capture the songs. You know,
there was a great, I read that letter that you wrote on your website. It's just sort of like an open letter to your fans or whatever. And there's a great, where was it? it was, you were talking about taking some time off after your last album and tour. It was, you said, Marie told me I treated the house like a hotel when I first came home. And that, like, that hit me right in the gut. That is my wife's biggest fucking complaint with me. First off, nobody's here to pick your shit up. So take care of it and unpack your fucking bag.
You know
what I mean? Like, I have a terrible habit. I'll leave my bag by our front door for like a week before I unpack. It drives my wife crazy. Like, just your home. Be home.
That's tricky though, isn't it? You almost need like a decompression chamber. When you're coming off tour, you almost need to go into quarantine. You know what I mean? Like, maybe 2 days of your own in a hotel just to get used to, okay, get my head ready to go back to normal life, you know?
It is a really tricky thing because, you know, your family, your kids get used to you not being there. That's the thing that fucks me up the most.
It's
like,
too.
I don't feel like they're sad about it, but I come home and everybody's off doing their, living their life, you know, and they've gotten used to their life being me not there. And that's the part that breaks my fucking heart.
I hear you, brother. I hear you on that one. That's a large, you know, the main reason I'm not going to be away as much next year, or, you know, haven't been away as much the last 2 years, you know, just stop touring. Because it goes quick.
It does.
You know what I mean? I remember this with Ella. You know, I was around, and, you know, I started getting really busy when we moved to London. Ella saw me a lot less then. But up until that point, you know, I got to spend most of my time with her. Or it was lovely. And I want to do the same with my son. You know what I mean? Because it just goes by quick.
You never get those years back.
No, sir.
I'm at that point where I'm having that realization where, fuck, my 16-year-old, I only have him for a couple more years, you know? That's kind of heavy, too.
Yeah.
You know?
I know, dude. That's wild when I look at Ella now, who's the same height as me.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Just looks like a woman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The amount of times we go out together and she gets offered a drink, or, you know, would you like, what are you having to drink?
Yeah.
She's like, juice, I'm only 16, you know? Yeah, it's kind of just, it's wild. You know that, there's a line in a Bonnie Raitt song that I always thought, I don't know how I got onto this from kids, but, oh, well, it's a nick of time. I think it's the third verse, you know, I see my parents growing old and I watch their bodies change. They say they see the same in me and it makes us both feel strange. No matter how you, no matter how much you tell yourself, it's what we all go through. Those lines are pretty hard to take when they're staring back at you. Holy shit, dude.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's it.
That's kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I hate to cut this short because I have so much other shit I wanted to get to, but I have to split to go. I have to go to the studio.
Yeah, it's all
good.
Will
you come back sometime? And
love
and,
to.
There's so much more I wanted to get into.
I think I'm seeing you later. Actually, are you going to this Apogee party?
Yeah. Oh, are you
going to
be there?
I'm going to that, yeah.
Oh, fuck.
As chance would have it.
Great. Yeah. Now we're playing at like 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, thanks for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. But I was caught up in a
fantasy. All right. So that was Mr. Foy Vance on Walking the Floor. As you can see, we ran out of time. He didn't get to play a song or anything like we normally do. But and I had a lot more questions that I wanted to get to. So like I said, hopefully he'll be back someday because he was great. I really enjoyed that. And I never did see him that night at that party. I thought I would. I looked for him, but it was a big, crazy party and there were a lot of people there. So hopefully we'll cross paths again soon. Foy Vance, Walking the Floor. And assuming I survive Vegas this weekend, I will be back again in a couple weeks with another fine edition of Walking the Floor. But that's it for now, kids. Adios, amigos!